Hi, my name is Martin Purnell and welcome to Off Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who do or don't go to church and for those that are disillusioned. Today's guest has just had her first book released by a major US publisher. Raised in a messianic Jewish home, her formative years of the 80s and 90s has given birth to a wonderfully succinct book entitled Orphaned Believers. What does this title actually mean? What is a messianic Jewish home like? Has she any baggage she would like to declare in this book? Gives me great pleasure to welcome today's guest all the way from Seattle, and that is Sarah Billups. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us again. What's the weather like in Seattle, please?
Thanks, Martin. I'm so happy to be here. You know, I bet the weather is a lot like where it is with you.
No.
It's cold and grey.
Yeah, it depends what your definition of cold is.
It's like, it's not bone chilling, but it is certainly not, it's like sweat, it's sweater weather. That's
yes,
what it is.
Just like a t-shirt and a sweater.
That's right. Oh, two layers.
Luxury. Yes. Moving on. Anyway, this is going to be great. You're one of the very few people that I actually ever buy a book, and it was through the book and a recommendation. And I thought, wow, we've got to get you on this podcast. So
I'm so glad you bought it. That's awesome.
Yes.
Thank you.
Just think of all the royalties you're going to get from me buying it off Amazon. More about the book later on. I'm on page 60 at the moment, which is high praise indeed. You know, because you only turned up last week. I'm doing quite well. Yeah. No, I'm enjoying it. I really am enjoying it. And there's no commission either on me saying that. So if you're sitting comfortably, then we shall begin with five questions. All right. Here we go. Fingers on the buzzers. No conferring, Sarah. If you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, who would it be?
So, Martin, I had to tell you that I didn't prep for these questions because I thought I'm just going off the top of my head. This could get a little weird, but I'm going to tell you who came to mind. Is Patti Smith the godmother of punk? Because I'd go back to New York when she was kind of coming up and writing Just Kids in the 70s. She's really influenced my aesthetic and writing style, and I love her so much. So having dinner would be a dream.
Wow. Yes. Because the Night, of course, was a big single over here. That was, I think, wasn't that originally written by Bruce Springsteen?
That's right. Bruce Springsteen wrote it, and I think she may have written a verse or two, but he wrote the chorus for sure.
That's a cracking idea to have Patti Smith over.
Yeah, total dream.
Yeah, it would be for you, wouldn't it? Yeah, exactly. Well, punk and new wave is my thing anyway. So, yes. 70s and 80s. Question two. Who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable, please, Sarah?
Oh, cool. You know, ever since I was a kid, it was John the Baptist. I think it's something about the kind of like wild spirit and nature of John the Baptist. The locust and honey thing was totally strange and interesting. And as an imaginative kid that likes stories, I could really visualize what it might be like to kind of be out in the wild. So there's just something, and also as a person that's always felt a little bit outside of culture and dominant culture, there's something that I really have grown to love about John the Baptist.
Could you eat honey every day though, and locusts?
There's no way. it only goes so far.
Yes, there's like, no, I've had enough, please. I know you can use honey to roast things with. It's great, you know, like your carrots and your parsnips, put honey on it and roast them in the oven. But locusts every day?
No, thanks. Yeah, I'd pass.
Question three. Now, you can either be Prime Minister of the UK or you can be President of the USA on this one. Who do you want to be?
Well, you know, I was in the UK in the fall. I know that it's not been the easiest time there, but I mean, you know that it's almost always a hot mess here in the States. So I'd say that I would be equally uninterested in either position, but I would say UK because as a total Anglophile and a person that thinks that the UK has much better culture, music, aesthetics. So I don't know about politics, but if I had to be in one place, boy, would I love to at least have joint residency in the UK.
You've done so well, but I'm going to say no. I'm not going to let you in because we don't have the fall over here. We have autumn. Or am I being too pedantic?
I can learn that a little bit.
So you're over here for the autumn then. Okay, I'm going to let you be Prime Minister okay, for the day over here in the United Kingdom.
Great. Okay,
right?
I like this already.
Here we go. So if you're Prime Minister for the day and could change any law or impose new law, Sarah Phillips, PM, what would it be?
Oh, geez. So this is when I should have looked at your questions ahead of
Thank
time.
Thank you.
My goodness.
Yes.
I think that the law would have to be that school lunch was given for free and was delicious and organic for every student.
Ooh.
Maybe that's true already, but in the States, we have a real problem.
We have a real problem over here as well, yeah.
Okay.
That is a great answer. You're the first person in 30-odd episodes to have chosen that answer.
Well, I'm relieved. I just got a little panicked. I'm not going to lie. So.
No, it's great. I mean, 20 years ago on TV, one of our TV chefs, you have TV chefs in America as well, called Jamie Oliver, he decided to do a big thing on this and take it to task. So, yes.
I remember. And then he came to the States and kind of tried to remake a school lunch system in like Virginia or somewhere on the East Coast.
Yeah.
So big fans of Jamie Oliver.
Oh, there you go. Excellent. Well, I'm sure if he's listening, he'll be going, oh, great. I must buy a book. Question four. Outside of family events, Sarah, what has been your most enjoyable day out to date?
Ooh. There's just so many that come to mind. So I'll just do a recent one. There's a old monastery in Seattle that's now been turned into a lodge called St. Edward's State Park. And it's just a gorgeous building and grounds. And so I've got an Australian Shepherd. We met some friends. I've got a couple kids. We all like hiked down to Lake Washington, which is a beautiful large lake that flanks the eastern side of Seattle. Mm-hmm. And we just hiked to the water. The dog swam in the water. It was just a really amazing day. And it was January, right? And so just the fact that I live in a place where that can happen was really great. And, you know, I'm from the Midwest, from Indiana, where you can't even go outside in January. At least as a kid, it was always snowy. So it felt pretty luxurious. But just a lot of joy being with other people and being outside.
Well, Indiana wants me, but I can't go back there.
Why is that?
Oh, no, I'm really showing my age. Sorry, it's a song. Ardeen Taylor.
That's
sorry. You don't know that song?
No, but I don't know how I don't know it, being a Hoosier.
Yeah, you're a child of this 70s and 80s, right? In the 60s, Ardeen Taylor was one of the employees of Motown, but he was their songwriter, and eventually he was allowed to let loose. And he goes down in the annals of famous pop history because he was the first white person to be allowed to record songs on the Motown label.
Well, see, now I've got something else to Google besides, is Patti Smith married? So now I'm making like a little mental list here.
Yeah, Ardeen Taylor. Oh, you've got to play Indiana Wants Me. Oh, what a track.
I can't wait to hear it.
Oh, yeah. I think Gotta See Jane. Oh, two stog. And there's A Ghost in My House as well. That's three songs he did. Oh, that's stunning.
I can't wait to listen. I mean, I love music, so I'd love to
hear it. It's almost as if I want to say, let's forget this interview. Let's have an Ardeen Taylor out.
Let's play it right now.
Good to do it. Yes, you mentioned two words there in the same sentence together, Australian and Shepherd. I've never heard of an Australian Shepherd dog. I know Belgian Shepherds. I know German Shepherds.
Yeah.
What's an Australian Shepherd?
Yeah, you know, it's a herding dog. And it's interesting that, you know, when we were over at in the UK, we didn't see any Aussies. And I was so surprised. But it's a herding dog. It's sort of mid-sized, just the most loyal, like lovely dogs. Looks a little bit like a Bernese Mountain Dog or like just a little bit longer hair, kind of a merle color, just really sweet. But I'm not sure if they're super common in the UK.
I was going to say, because if you say Belgian Shepherd or German Shepherd, you know, we think of guard dogs, you know, and they can be obviously fantastic. But what you're saying now is an Aussie Shepherd is nothing like that at all.
Yeah, it's more like a cowboy. It's like the favorite herding dog of like a cowboy. So it's that kind of, I don't know why it's called Australian, but it's certainly very beloved in America.
Oh, wow. Maybe it bounces a lot or something like that on four legs.
totally.
Right. Well, question five then. Apart from the fact you didn't look at these questions, what has been your most embarrassing moment, please, Sarah?
Oh, geez. I mean, there are so many to choose from. Okay. Well, one really embarrassing moment was my freshman year of college. I was walking to like a class in the communications building on a campus in the Midwest. And I had a woman run up behind me and say, "Excuse me, ma'am." And I said, "What is it?" And she said, "Your dress is tucked into your tights." Yes. And so I looked back and it was horrifying. I mean, I was 18. I thought I was going to like wither onto the sidewalk. Luckily, nobody was around and she was lovely, but it could have been a really, really bad class.
Yes. You're not the first to have said that.
And yeah. Okay. So I was.
You're not the first. And other people.
I was the first healthy school lunch, but not the first tuck and tight.
No. I used to do this all years ago when I was on radio, and I also remember somebody saying not only was that not tucked in their tights was their dress, but also the toilet roll as well.
Okay. So it could have been worse.
It could have been far worse. Yes. You could be far worse. Well, I have to say, Sarah, you did very well there, considering you wanted to push yourself to the limits to see if you could answer all five questions without looking at the questions first. You did very well.
I feel pretty energized right now, so I'm glad we got that out of the way.
Excellent. Well, first of all, then, this before we go into the main thrust of the interview, stroke chinwag, because I don't really want an interview. I just like to have a conversation. Who is Sarah Phillips, please?
Mm-hmm. I'm a writer based in Seattle in the U.S., grew up in the Midwest, like I mentioned, like we've talked about, Indiana. Yeah. And my husband and I moved out about 20 years ago. We were really interested in co-housing and intentional communities. And this is a time in the church, at least in the States, where there was a missional church movement. There was a lot of people talking about returning to the city, like Tim Keller, who runs Redeemer Church in Manhattan. There were these ideas of new monasticism coming up by writers like Shane Claiborne. We were really interested in coming to the city and starting a church plant or a retreat center or something to see if we could help what we thought would be help Seattle. Mm-hmm. We really quickly learned that Seattle kind of assimilated us pretty quickly. And that's an idea that is in the This Cultural Moment podcast that John Mark Comer and Mark Sayers talk about. Like, we thought we were coming here to plan a community and that Seattle would like welcome us with open arms, but pretty quickly, and this is in the early 2000s, a lot of us started using terms like I'm spiritual, but not religious. It's kind of like before the word deconstruction, folks would talk about being spiritual, not religious. It was just a bewildering time where Drew, my husband, and I were going to church on Sunday, but I was just working downtown during the week. And my life did not look or feel any different than anybody else that didn't identify as a Christian. In fact, I kind of stopped talking about it here because it's tiring to explain what you mean by Christian in a progressive place like Seattle. And I wasn't even sure how I felt about God for a little while. Mm. So, you know, fast forward to 2016, I began to really have something to say. I was writing professionally, but I began to write privately about faith and culture, and then to finally share that work in 2018. And to try to kind of grow a community of folks that are interested in this idea of being an orphaned believer. And when I say that, I just mean anyone looking around the church right now in America or in the West and having a hard time finding Jesus, like somebody that is looking for Jesus but not finding Jesus in the church. So that's kind of what led to the book. And so I wrote my first book, and it came out from Baker Books about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
As of this
book. Yeah. And it made its way over to England already, into Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. You know, it's amazing. In 2 weeks. That's fantastic. So you just mentioned there, you were a writer. How did you get into writing professionally? What happened?
Yeah, well, you know, I was a creative writing major in undergrad. I'm in my mid-40s now, but had always written as a kid creatively. And then started to work in publishing and just started to edit some websites and online media, and then began to explore writing about food, writing about coffee. I was editing a restaurant website about the industry. So really just got into writing about fun stuff and doing some reporting. And so then began to do a little bit of opinion writing, writing about nonprofits, some other pieces. So I was doing a lot. At one point, I was editing a restaurant website here in Seattle and writing up to 6 articles a day. I mean, I was just like pumping out content like a machine.
Yeah.
But I was not finding a lot of value or meaning in that work. And so I went back to grad school in my late 30s and studied nonprofit leadership, became really interested in food issues and food access. I think that's why my mind went to school lunch, and then began to work in nonprofits doing communication work now, which is what I do. So kind of like transitioned into that space. So professionally have a day job, but write creatively and certainly consider writing and being an author my other job, my evenings and weekends job.
Yeah. That's fantastic. You mentioned, excuse me, as I said earlier on, my asthma's really playing up tonight. So that'll teach me for eating chocolate beforehand, as I said. Mm-hmm. And looking at your website, as well as reading your book, you've come up with some fantastic corkers of statements. And one of them that really got me going, think, wow, because I had the pleasure of talking to Wayne Jacobson, who co-authored, stroke collaborated on The Shack, that book that sold by the bucket load quite a few years ago. That's going out in a couple of weeks' time. But you said it here, there is this feeling in the white American church that we talk about what's broken because it focuses on the negative. And I'm thinking, what a great statement. So perhaps we can deconstruct that statement, if that's all right. Tell me more.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's easy in thinking about culture wars. So the book is split into 3 sections. You talk about end times and kind of growing up as an end times kid, where I was told that the rapture would come before I'd be able to have a family or sort of career. And then the second part's about culture wars. The third part's about consumerism and how the market interacts with our faith. But when it comes to culture wars specifically, I think that we're really tempted to kind of make a straw man or to kind of tear apart in order to make ourselves feel safe or seen or like we have some kind of stake in the ground. But I think when we do that, the message of Jesus, which is certainly to be formed from the inside out and to serve others first, really gets turned upside down pretty quickly. And so I think that the idea of not withdrawing from the world but embracing the world in health while living differently is hard to do. But when we judge other people, that is certainly a very difficult path to walk. So that's something that I've been learning about and working through in my own life as best I can.
Because I mentioned Wayne Jacobson and the book The Shack. You can find loads of people who fly the flag saying, what a great book, this is really, and then you can get other people just by going on YouTube and no, heresy, blasphemy. But something that statement really meant a lot to me, actually, because what you're saying is that maybe we should forget so much about the bad things. So those people that are like having a go at the book The Shack, turning it around saying, well, what about the positives that come out of that book? Why is it we nowadays have to find all the negatives rather than dwell on the positives?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think social media has helped. I mean, certainly in America, in the American church, starting in 2016 when Trump ran, I mean, Martin, I don't know anybody that hasn't had a severed relationship with a family member or a former pastor. Like, there's been such a fractioning relationally in the States specifically, which is my only, my experience, which is why I keep kind of reinforcing that viewpoint. There's just been such a fracturing, and it seems like social media lets anybody feel like they're an authority or can say anything with little prudence, space for discernment, or any kind of context that's a little bit broader or more trustworthy. And so I think that it's become a really damaging tool in a lot of ways. I mean, it's interesting because I think social media builds real community, helps people that feel a little bit lost find each other, but can also be very divisive. And so I think part of the reason is that we all are kind of, I read in the book about being a micro-authoritarian, like we all kind of get to be the king of our own little kind of like piece of land as opposed to trying to kind of build bridges. We're all pretty cut off right now. And so it's a lonely time to identify as a Christian in the States, especially if you're really trying to be transformed and pursue Jesus in the presence of some pretty complicated dynamics in the American church.
Yeah. Well, Well, that's the thing, though, isn't it? Why has it become so complicated? Because as I was sharing with a friend of mine just a couple of hours ago via social media, i.e. text on WhatsApp, you know, if Jesus just gave us two commandments, which are basically, right, love the Lord your God with your heart and soul, and love your neighbour as yourself, I mean, what could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think that, my mind's going in so many different directions.
Go for it.
I think that part of the problem is that the cross, like the church critiques all political parties, like there's not a right or wrong way. I think that our minds just want to snap to one way or the other. Like, I think that the message I'm trying to deliver is hopefully one that resonates to people with different opinions about political issues, about social issues. Like, the truth is, like, the glue, the great binder is Jesus. And I think that if we're taking that seriously, it means that we're being spiritually formed by healthy practices that can serve as an inoculation against judging other people, that we can learn to extend empathy first, even though that's very difficult and not natural because of our brokenness. And I think that when I say formation, I just mean, you know, like inner disciplines like prayer or fasting, outer disciplines like service, corporate disciplines like church or some kind of community, whatever that looks like for you, can be kind of like a vitamin or like an inoculation against forces that are trying to form us, be that if we buy one more thing, we'll be happier, have our best life ever. Yeah. Or if we believe a certain way or vote a certain way, it means we're okay. I mean, those don't hold up in the upside down kingdom of Jesus.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to give away the plot of the book too much because I'm only on page 60, but let's look at the title in more detail, if that's right. I mean, Orphaned Believers, great title. How'd you come up with it?
Well, you know, the title is actually from a song by the band Over the Rhine, which is a band that's based in Ohio here that I love. And the song's called All My Favorite People. The lyrics are, all my favorite people are broken. Believe me, my heart would know. Orphaned believers, skeptical dreamers, you're welcome. You don't have to go. You know, and so I just loved that song. And as a writer, I found something literary and kind of like open to interpretation about this idea of being an orphaned believer. I think some folks identify more with a kind of feeling of orphaning culturally or spiritually, and others more to believer or vacillate towards one word or the other, depending on the day. But when I use that term, I mean folks that have either experienced a cultural orphaning, like I mentioned here in Seattle, it's less common to identify as a Christian. And I think this is probably true in parts of the UK as well, but certainly here, if you go to church, it's not accidentally. If you go to church, it's actually refreshing. Like, if you're showing up, it means that you probably want to be there.
Yes.
But on the other hand, being here, meeting someone new and talking about faith, it's very exhausting to explain if you're a Christian but not that kind or what that means. It's just a bigger kind of investment of conversation, and it's tiring and discouraging sometimes to talk about that here. But on the other hand, culturally, maybe if you live in part of America that's the Bible Belt, or a part of the world where the church is really ubiquitous and it's common to talk about being a Christian, there can sometimes be isolation if you don't identify with the big industry around Christianity sometimes, or like huge conferences or like stadium concert tours. There's just a alienation that can come if you're looking around and not feeling like there's room for art or ideas or counterculture. It's just a strange space. So there's the cultural stuff, but then I also think about orphaned believers in terms of a spiritual orphaning. And when I say that, I just mean people pursuing Jesus who feel like they've been hung out to dry by the church, who can't square their reading of the gospel with what they're seeing right now in the church, with celebrity pastors that have fallen, with many abuse cases, with so much that's gone wrong, with America, the idea that to be a Christian, specifically an evangelical, means that you're a Republican. There's a long list.
Yes, and no doubt we'll talk about that later on, about how politics seems to be entwined even more now with Christianity. But going back to a statement you made, and you were giving us an idea of the insular and then the outward side, and then you said the corporate side of Christianity was going to church. as you have probably heard from my initial gambit, you know, I'm trying to do these podcasts for people who do go to church or don't go to church, or for those that are just disillusioned. Mm-hmm. And I was told last week on another podcast that will be going out soon that in America there seems to be a thing called the Duns now.
Yeah, there was a new article about that recently.
So to my understanding is that you're done with going to church. You're not giving up on God, but you're just done with going to church, hence the Duns. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I wrote this book for people in that space. I talk to people, I hear from people every day that are struggling with their relationship with church. And so I'm really honest about how in the book, like, you know, I actually, Drew and I have gone to the same church in Seattle in Capitol Hill neighborhood for 18 years, since the first Sunday we rolled up.
Wow.
We've seen that church go through many ups and downs. We tend to be faithful people. Sometimes I joke that we're stupidly faithful, like we're very optimistic. But I kind of think you have to be in the business of trying to reimagine what the church could be, you know. But when I think about the church or why we still need the church or what that means, I'm really careful about how I talk about it, because it's personal, tender work. And so many people in my life that I love, and even my own experiences coming up in the 80s and 90s, like in other churches before this one, have been complicated. Like, I've had Sundays where I had to walk out and leave the sanctuary because there was just a palpable weight or sadness on me. Like, I understand that dynamic. But so, like, when I say church, I mean, I think about Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Like, we serve a Trinitarian God if we identify as Christians. Like, we're made to be communal. We're reflecting that community. And so to me, church is just the gathered body of believers. And it's the best that we have, because it's what Christ left us with. He left us with each other. And we just seem to make a fine mess of the church throughout the ages over and over again. But I think that it's right to believe the church will always exist, because it was called to existence by God, by Christ, and it's shepherded and cared for by Christ. But so the only way it will disappear is if it's a myth, and I believe that it's true. So I think the question is, how do we work for its health and renewal and restoration? And there's two ways to do that. One, there's folks within the church that want to, at least from my American context, be a true witness to Jesus instead of being a part of a culturally co-opted experiment that has failed, that can, if we have hearts burning for change, work to reform the church from within. And there are those of us that need to take a break, that need time away for our own health, for security or safety if we've been harmed. There are many reasons why people need to take a break from church. So there's, I mean, I could make a long list. So I think what I would say is, the church, if it is the gathered body of believers, means that we're called to be in community. And so even if that's two or three people, even if that's some kind of online space for a while, like, whatever that looks like, I don't think there's a formula. I think it's just a matter of not resisting isolation, because I think that's when things become especially complicated and hard for us.
Do you know, you're the second person I know who's said that to me, that, you know, if it means taking a break for your own, to sum it all up, your mental health or whatever, take a break. But then it's down to you personally. Obviously, it's a bit difficult with me because I live over here and you're in Seattle. Yeah. But it'd even be down to you to make sure that person's still okay outside of the church-going times of 9, 10, 11 o'clock Sunday morning, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that, again, like the isolation, the part where we, where if church is hard or triggering and we take a break, I think that is well and good. But I think that that means, again, being spiritually formed to have our own practices of prayer or silence. And you know, the other thing, sometimes I'll talk to folks that say, I can't pray, I don't know what to pray. And like, I would say, when I've been in that situation, which I have been, sometimes I've just prayed the word help. I mean, I'll tell you that the answer has almost always been through community or other people, comes back to other people. And then sometimes I'll just read a psalm, you know, if I can't pray. So I think that even if you are taking a break from church, like, just finding ways to stay grounded or connected is hard, but really vital.
How much of it do you think is it the church's fault for people to leave church these days?
I mean, yeah, I think that I think a lot of it is the church. I mean, I'm not sure about the word fault, but I think that a lot of the brokenness, the need for celebrity pastors, for power, for security, for finances to be used instead of giving back to the community and serving other people, instead to kind of like buy a new smoke machine or something for stage. It's really gross. Like, there's just a lot of gross misuse of resources, of funds, of propping up pastors that they're almost like have an ear, a closer ear to the ground, to God directly. And how can you question them? There's like a lot of problems. On the other hand, I think about my mother. My mother-in-law lives in Baltimore. She volunteers every week in the city serving meals. She shows up all the time. Like, she goes to a Southern Baptist church. I think that my husband and I have different views politically and in some ways socially than her. But like, my mother-in-law is doing quiet, beautiful service, and it will never be headline getting. So the stuff that we hear, at least in the States, is certainly, she's never going to be like the focus of an article. So I also want to acknowledge that they're all along have been people quietly and faithfully doing works of service that are really beautiful in the ordinary of life that we don't hear about or think about too. So I just want to paint a really human picture of it.
I mentioned at the beginning as well, and we will talk more about the book in a minute, if that's right. Or when I say a minute, you know, a few minutes. Sure. Slight exaggeration. About your parents. I know, because reading your book, it's like, whoa, you know, you come from a Jewish background. Nothing wrong with that at all, don't get me wrong. But the fact that your father put two and two together, you know, that must have been some taking for him to do that. What do you remember his stories telling you? What happened?
Yeah, sure. My dad converted to Christianity in the 70s. He grew up in a Reformed Jewish home in Indiana and was at a Bible study at a friend's house on the book of Daniel. So it was about a sort of prophetic book. Had a very radical conversion experience where he just like, he talks about it in a way that sounds kind of like a movie, but he says he just like got up, leapt over the couch, ran to the parking lot, and like fell on his face on the concrete and accepted Jesus, like this big moment. And when people saw him after, they didn't recognize him. Like, people said his face looked different. He had a radical conversion, but also very much loves, you know, his Jewish past, his history, his genetics. Like, it's a beautiful and big part of my dad. I mean, my dad took a 23andMe test, you know, one of those genetic tests, and he found out that he is 99.9% Ashkenazi Jewish. It's the most you can get. No one gets 100. And it was like the best day of his life, because Larry David, who he's kind of like, do you know Larry David? He's an American comedian. He was 99.5% on his test. So dad was even Jewisher than his favorite Jewish comedian. So I grew up celebrating some Jewish holidays, like certainly Hanukkah and Christmas. It was always a part of my life. But the other thing about my dad is that when he got saved, it was very much in a time in culture when there was a lot of fear of the apocalypse, of Christian scare movies. The book, The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey, was top of the bestseller list on the New York Times, selling more copies than The Joy of Sex. I mean, just, it was ubiquitous. It was in the water here. And so I grew up hearing about Christianity and Judaism and almost as equally that the world would end and that the rapture was coming. So this is a premillennial dispensationalist take on end times. And so that instilled a lot of fear. So it was a really interesting mix of dynamics as a kid growing up. And so the book kind of explores my relationship with my dad and what it was like growing up with him. The last thing I'll say about his Jewishness is that a lot of evangelicals are really curious about Israel. They love like Holy Land tours. I mean, I'd love to go to, I've never gone to Israel. I'd love to go. So I think it'd be amazing. But in terms of, there's a subculture around some older evangelicals that are very into like Messianic Judaism as a kind of subculture. Yeah. And that's something that my dad, who was not, he was always the funny kid and not super popular in his family. Like, a lot, there was a lot of intellectualism in his family. He didn't really catch on to that. When he converted to Christianity, dad became really popular with his friends. We'd go to dinner or lunch after church and everyone loved hearing dad talk about Judaism. So that was an interesting other piece of his story that I definitely experienced as a kid.
But the other side of the coin, I don't know whatever happened there, but quite often people who experience becoming a Christian often find that their relations shun them, don't want to know anything about them. You know, what about yourself growing up as a kid?
Yeah, I mean, my dad was, you know, I think when my dad converted, it was a big surprise to his family. And he was estranged from his parents for a little while. They reconciled later. So for me, with that side of the family, they were always really, again, intellectual, successful, cool, left Indiana, went to the coast. I was always really enamored with that side of the family. But for me, I certainly grew up identifying as a Christian, going to church, but the kind of Christianity and evangelicalism that I experienced was certainly one that was very colored by my parents' own interpretations of what that culture was. And so, like, as I write about in the book, I mean, the end times thing was really a thick thread. And I remember going to this ice cream shop with my friend in high school, and we were sitting in this back booth. She had a banana split, and I was telling her about there's going to be a rapture and a 7-year tribulation period. And like, by the time I talked about the battle of Gog and Magog, I can literally see her spoon suspended like in air and her mouth dropped open. I mean, I was really kind of regurgitating what I'd heard.
Yes.
It wasn't until much later that my own experience of Jesus and faith became more authentic and my own. It took a little while.
Well, I became a Christian in 1987. And I think the way of describing the way I became a Christian was a bit how C.S. Lewis wrote it, that he went to bed that night the most despondent of all Christians. Because it's the same with me. It was like, oh, right, okay, where are the fireworks? Oh, they didn't happen. But immediately I was thrust into these new words, these three new words, amillennialism, postmillennialism, premillennialism.
Yeah. And
it's like, to this day, I can't remember which one I'm supposed to be. And yet it was all built up as if it was really important.
Yeah.
Why totally. Do we do that?
That's right. I mean, okay, so premillennialism is this idea that was popularized by this preacher, John Nelson Darby, in the mid-1700s. And so it's this idea that the book of Revelation he read literally to be interpreted into dispensations, or these seven time eras. And so that is a view that Jesus will return before the world gets really bad, essentially. And then postmillennialism, which was popular before then, was really saying it's more optimistic, social gospel oriented, that the world, our call is to make the world better, you know? And so it really caught on in the States after the Second World War, when things were pretty, pretty abysmal. And then when, you know, the 70s came around, it was after Vietnam, there was the Cold War. I mean, it was a time of real charged political politics in the States. And so that the message when Late Great Planet Earth was written, or there were Christian scare movies, I mean, Ronald Reagan was using apocalyptic language from the stump when he was president, which was criticized. But there was a lot of big Hollywood movies about the apocalypse. There was a real fear of the enemy, or what that meant, that really crept in. And so that message really resonated, you know, the idea that maybe we could leave and Jesus would return before we had to experience really bad stuff, I think was really comforting to people like my dad. And so by the time I came around, we talked about the end times at dinner like families talk about football. I mean, it was like a sport. At dinner, we talk about when the world would end, if you could lose your salvation, if you had to be baptized to be saved. There were just a few issues that we were really focused on. So, but again, Martin, it's complicated because my dad had a beautiful conversion. My parents loved Jesus. Like, I was brought up loving Jesus and being and feeling loved. And so it wasn't, it's hard to talk about in a way that's like, this was bad. Like, it was real and messy. And that's just part of my story.
But you might have nailed it there, because if I'd been invited around, let's say, to meet your mum and dad for a meal, come in, right, and he says, well, I am such and such millennialist, and I go, well, actually, I disagree with you. I'm a such and such millennialist. Would he throw me out? What would he have done?
No, he would not have thrown you out. The interesting thing about my dad is he doesn't take himself too seriously, and so it's hard to explain to someone who hasn't met him. But for example, the book that I wrote is honest and critical about the way that my dad raised me with this fear, but it's also tender. And in a lot of ways, my dad's my best friend. And I just like, I adore him. And so he's very loving. He doesn't take himself too seriously, but yet he totally and with complete fervor believes till this day he will be raptured and will not die.
Yeah.
So it is an interesting personality thing with him.
Yeah,
but, but he would be happy to have you at dinner and to talk to you all you wanted about the raptor.
Yes, but I think the point I was trying to make as well is that he wouldn't have thrown me out, like you quite rightly said, because, you know, he loves Jesus. So why would he throw me out? And yet, often, we can maybe go to somebody else's house and they'd be more than happy to throw me out because I disagree with them.
That's right.
So, that's right. So what do we say to them then?
We'll say to them, you should meet this guy Tom in Seattle because he'll have you for dinner and he will not throw you out. Yeah, seriously. I mean, it's a good point, isn't it? And it makes me think about how, interestingly, I've written some, this is a little, I think this applies. I've written some op-eds and some pieces for just national news outlets or outlets that are not in any way related to the church. Mm-hmm. And people have responded with such curiosity and grace and inquisitiveness. But I've written content for Christian publications and there's been the most divisive, very difficult and very vitriolic comments. And mm-hmm. it is just, I still can't wrap my mind around it, honestly. It is really interesting. It just is like evidence of how the church is so deeply divided. But yet I do not lose hope because I believe that there is always going to be a remnant of the church that's renewing and working to really pursue Jesus in a way that changes our lives. And, you know, by the time I got to my 30s, when I had fully shed a lot of that stuff from what I heard from my parents, I just began to realize if I'm going to take this stuff seriously, if I'm actually going to identify as a Christian, it needs to change me. What am I doing? Yeah, what's the point? I believe there's actually a virgin birth and a resurrection and Jesus came to earth to save if I believe this stuff, it has to change me. So that was I still remain hopeful in spite of some pretty serious division.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, again, stupidly optimistic.
That's good, isn't it? Actually, there's a song called Stupidly Happy, but that's the same sort of thing. That's great. So imagine then someone just comes into your house, all right? They haven't been thrown out by your dad, but they say, look, I'm really confused about it. I don't want to go to church. I just can't. I've been hurt or whatever. And I'm sure there are people today, and this is why I'm asking it, that will be listening. So what wise words would we get from Sarah Billups from Seattle, please, as to what you'd say to them?
Yeah, I think I would say, if you can't go to church right now, don't go to church and don't feel bad about it. If you're doubting, normalize doubt. Doubt is not the opposite of faith. It's a healthy way to get to the point where we are asking hard questions. God can take those questions. I think that when we start, just welcome the questions like you would if you were talking to a friend, you know? And I think I'd say the way that I grew up, there was such a cultural pressure for a salvation moment. Again, talking about my dad's conversion, I think that sometimes, whether it be radically or like C.S. Lewis and We're Quiet, I think we do have moments where we make a choice to commit our lives to God. I'm not speaking theologically, but culturally, I think that there is a lot of fear. Am I really saved? Did I do it right? At least for a lot of folks in my generation, I would come up every night, I would pray the Lord's Prayer and ask God into my heart, and I do it again. And I get hundreds of times, thousands of times, because I wanted to be sure. But I think that I've come to believe and see in my life that God can carry us, that if we're in seasons of doubt or seasons where we can't be in church, that God can use other people to carry us through and we can carry each other. And I think in health, the church can do that too. It can be a place, the right congregation can be a place to carry folks in doubt and to let us have space. But my husband's done that for me through that 10 years in Seattle when I was really flailing, and I've done that for him. So I think there's this beautiful way in which if we have the gift of long life, it can take a little while, but I think that can be really calming and reassuring as opposed to scary or anxiety inducing. I say that as a person that walked through a spiritual desert for more than a decade. I see the goodness of God and the evidence of God throughout that whole time. And so I'm really non-anxious about it. And I think that normalizing doubt, asking questions, and letting ourselves be carried or loved by other people is a really beautiful and gentle way forward. So I say that, and I also say that God can do what God wants to do, and maybe that is a radical healing or change or something big, but I think usually it's small and slow and really beautiful looking back, even if right now it feels scary, isolating, or hard.
Yeah. No, I hear that. Something you said there, and I'm not trying to be deliberately rude to pry into it, because obviously the end result is you've written this amazing book that even me is reading it, you know, so that's high praise indeed. But you said you're in a spiritual desert, and yet again, yeah. I'm going for those people that listen today who are like, oh, I just can't cope anymore. Please tell us more about what you mean by the spiritual desert.
Oh, sure. So we landed in Seattle, like I'd mentioned. We thought we were going to do this big thing. The city was really big. We didn't understand what we were doing here. And so in that time, the co-housing project we were in ended. We moved, my husband and I moved to a little apartment in Capitol Hill. He decided to go back to seminary at Fuller and kind of had this main idea. I was just kind of flailing. I would walk downtown a mile to work and back every day. It was a time of loneliness and isolation, and a time when I began to realize if I had like a light under a bushel, it was almost snuffed out. I mean, the weight of trying to maintain two identities, of being a Christian, but being ashamed, not talking about it, not knowing how I felt, not seeing God's fruit in my life. The only way I can explain it is that it began to feel like a physical weight, almost like there was a feeling like I was carrying a bag on my shoulder filled with rocks. Like I had to, something had to give. And so by the time in 2016, I started to talk about this more, or at least quietly write about it, it became freeing. And when in 2018, I finally started to share, it became liberating. The thing that happened to me is that I started writing and building community with other folks like in a similar place. And I started to explore spiritual direction and some other, you know, there was a real skepticism of Catholicism growing up. And that's a really common thread with a lot of evangelical kids. Like maybe are Catholics really Christian? So there was a lot of suspicion. But when I began to embrace a lot of spiritual disciplines, the exam and the Lectio Divina, when I began to understand contemplative practices, Ignatian spirituality, it became profoundly transformative in my faith. And so at the end of that decade, there was a commitment to prayer, which really became more about listening than talking, and a real spaciousness that opened up, as well as the sort of getting over the fear of talking about my faith. And so that feeling of like a bag on my shoulder of rocks, I felt really free because of God's goodness. Because I, like I mentioned earlier, I realized I had to either push in or what am I doing? What am I doing here?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. No, thank you for saying that. And of course, you know, we've talked a lot about your dad and the up to the page 60 that I'm up at the moment, you know, he's got a terrible illness. And I didn't want to ask, you know, has he made it? Yeah. But obviously he's talking in the present tense. So that's really, really good news.
My dad was diagnosed with multiple myeloma, which is a treatable but not curable kind of cancer, blood and bone cancer, about 2.5 years ago. Mm. And so in the book I write about the fact that he fully believes he'll be raptured and also will certainly die of this disease. But he is currently in doing well in treatment, and he is living. And so just yesterday I posted on Instagram, we went to a local bookstore here and they had the book. And so him being able to see it on the shelf, was such a joy. So I didn't know if he'd be able to read it or see it. So my mom and dad have read it out loud together. It's been very healing for our relationship. We've had a lot of really, even as recently as last night, a lot of really redemptive talks have come out of the book. So it's been a gift.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you know the fact that he's read the book.
Yeah.
It's especially how you've been so honest as to what's going on. Yeah. What did he say?
He said just yesterday, I think that I'm realizing, he said, I think the book is changing me because I see that I was really rigid and that now I see more than ever that even if we're different on certain issues theologically, like we both love Jesus and that's the most important thing. So it's been a clarifying process and I think emotional for all of us too. So it just goes to show how awesome he is that he's not self-conscious. He's really gracious and excited. So he's a special person.
You see, and the terrible black humor in me is going, yes, yes, yes. Yeah. But you're a premillennialist or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But you've just nailed it because he loves Jesus, you know, and that trumps everything, doesn't it?
It's the common denominator. That's right.
That's right. So even though you might have big arguments with him, actually, they're not really big arguments at all. They're just conversation piece, but we just build them up as to...
That's right. I mean, I thought of that, you know, that famous MLK quote, the arc of, what is it? Oh, the arc of history is long, but it's bent towards justice. I mean, if all things really are being made right in the end, whatever listeners think about the Book of Revelation or how you read it and interpret it, like what we know is that in the end, all things will be made well, that Jesus will make all of the, my kids' Bible, my kids have a Bible that talks about the sad things being made untrue. Like, we know that the sad things will be made untrue in the end, and however we get there and whatever that means, if we have that common denominator of moving towards Jesus, that just gives me nothing but hope.
It's brilliant. I mean, now we're into such a good thing. I'd say, come and have some more coffee. You know, if I was in Seattle, let's talk about something else. But unfortunately, running short of time, unfortunately. But in light of now, we know what the trump card is. You know, this is, you know, Jesus loves us. There's another question that you've thrown up on your website, and that is calling for reformation in the American church.
Yeah.
Wow. What's the game plan?
Ooh, you know, if I think about, so there's tons of young people leaving the church. Everyone sees those headlines are often seen. There's even statistics that in America, the evangelical church is growing, and that doesn't make any sense, except that after the Trump election, there's kind of a social and political club that's growing around certain pockets of churches, instead of a real spiritually transformative kind of call or conversion. And so, you know, because Trump focused on winning while Jesus lost, essentially, you know? And so it's interesting to watch. Jesus laid down his life and says, those who lose their life will find it. And so it's the opposite of power. It's the releasing of power. And so when I look at the church, I think things are gonna get worse, more fractured, more denomination splitting. I don't know that I see we're at some kind of sea change and now it's finally going to be hopeful. I think things are going to get harder and sadder in a lot of ways, but I think that that's like a natural kind of clarifying process to go through, to be at the point where, like, those of us, again, with hearts burning for change can see a real life. And the only way we get there is through loving and serving each other and modeling our lives so that we can talk to people that aren't Christians and say, hey, this is why I'm a Christian, and bear examples in our life of how that might look different than someone that's clearly kind of into Trump and politics and whatever and says they're evangelical or whatever. You know, like, by bearing with our life, service and love. That's the only way forward. And it seems, again, hearing myself, like, going back to love, that seems so simplistic. Jesus loves me. That seems so simplistic. But on the other hand, you know, I think a lot of us that came up in the era that I did had a lot of fear and didn't really believe that we were loved. I mean, I did a 2-year kind of prayer thing where every morning I'd read a verse on love, because it took that long to begin to believe that I actually am loved by God. This is in my 30s. So I think that that's actually a profound journey and not just kind of a platitude to talk about that being the answer. So I just popped around there, but my mind was going all over the place with that one.
Well, it's fantastic. And unfortunately, we're running out of time. We've just got one more question, really, before we go to your hero, your Christian hero, which you have to talk for 2 minutes on who your Christian hero is. And obviously, can't be in the Bible, can't be someone that's alive, just in case, you know, that person years to come becomes someone horrible. Go, oh, look. So, but before we get to that question, I just got a feeling that you're not actually a Republican.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I don't talk about specific, that's the other thing. I'm glad you mentioned that. I don't tell anybody how to vote. I don't talk specifically about candidates. I think there's plenty to critique about all political parties. When I talk about Trump, I specifically think that his entire platform has co-opted American Christianity to gain power. And it has been a horrific thing to live through. So I can talk about Christian nationalism and President Trump all day. But in terms of my own political stance, I think it's much more nuanced, and I certainly don't have an agenda about that piece. That's kind of what I'd say.
Yeah. And also, you know, over a cup of coffee, it's been talked in love. You know, we're just learning. You know, that'd be your view. I'm sure I could find somebody who'd come in and go, no, you're wrong, Sarah.
I'm sure you can. That would be a cool conversation. Maybe we should.
Well, you never know. We might have to do that sometime soon. That'd be really good, wouldn't it? Have a nice cup of coffee.
There you go. Really good. I'll make a fresh pot.
Say again.
I'll make a fresh pot for that conversation.
I'll look forward to that. Listen, it's been brilliant talking to you and about your book. Your book is called what?
Orphans, Believers, How a Generation of Christian Exiles Can Find the Way Home.
Brilliant. And as I said, I've started to read it. And if you want to know more about premillennialism, postmillennialism, all those sorts of things, the great thing about the book is it's not like 12 pages on a subject. It's like one page. And in my language, it's in Janet and John language, you know, whereby you can, you can be broken down. So I'm looking forward to reading the rest of the book. Thank you so much, Sarah. Final question then. Here we go. Who is your Christian hero, please?
Well, I without a doubt would say Eugene Peterson, who was a theologian, scholar, pastor, that died in 2018. But I'm currently doing my doctorate of ministry at Western Seminary in Michigan, and it's a part of the new Peterson Center for the Christian Imagination. So there's two cohorts, and mine's called The Sacred Art of Writing. And so really, it's about Eugene Peterson's call towards beauty and imagination and poetry and the Psalms, just like very inspired by a person that really was a saint and lived faithfully the whole way through. I mean, we hear headlines about somebody passing or a pastor that kind of fell from grace. It's so refreshing to see somebody with like a wholesomeness and a goodness that really lived differently with his finances and really grappled with fame or ego or what that meant. It's so refreshing to see somebody that's a faithful saint the whole way through. So Wynne Collier's biography on Peterson, Burning in My Bones, is awesome. I definitely recommend it. So I'm going to say Eugene.
And where's he from?
He grew up in Montana, but he lived actually in Maryland, in the same small town my husband grew up in, randomly. So he was a pastor in Maryland for a long time.
Oh, wow.
But Montana is where I think who can claim him.
Did your husband know him at all, growing up in Maryland?
No, he grew up a couple blocks from his church, but they never crossed paths.
Wow. And for those who are saying, name Eugene Peterson, that rings a bell. That rings a bell.
Oh, he wrote the message translation of the Bible.
You did.
Right.
And lots of people like it as well, don't they?
Yeah, the Psalms specifically are quite beautiful to read. Wow. Very conversational.
Well, so how long is your course going to be?
I'm about halfway through, so it's about 3 years. And it's been a total gift. Love it. It's been really, really good.
And when you finish, what are your qualifications? What we have after your name or before your name?
It's a doctorate of ministry or a D period min, but my kids love like howl with laughter saying, oh, mom's going to get a demon. Mom's getting a demon. it never gets old. So I'll be a demon.
Well, there you go. You're our favorite demon then for in a couple of years time. Sarah Billups, thank you so much for joining us. And I'm going to take you up on that cup of coffee one day soon.
This has been so much fun. Thank you.
Thank you. Cheers. God bless.